This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You may have seen your friends on Facebook over the last week checking in at Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Many of them weren't physically there, but their acknowledgement of this place is a sign of growing attention and support of the Standing Rock Sioux. The tribe, found in North and South Dakotas, has been protesting a multi-billion dollar pipeline project near its reservation. Today, Where We Live, we look at why the issue has attracted other Indian nations and many other Americans to join the Sioux in protesting the pipeline. They include Connecticut tribes. We'll speak to members of the Mohegan and Mashantucket Pequot tribes about the significance of this moment for Native American people. And we'll hear how the past informs today's current events. And later, many of us wouldn't mind cheaper utility bills, but at what cost? Advocates for cleaner energy say the region should be investing in more renewable energy than in fossil fuels. Greg Gladke, the Hartford Courant's environmental reporter, will be here later to explain why natural gas pipeline projects have stalled here in Connecticut and elsewhere in New England. First, have you been paying attention to Standing Rock? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email Where We Live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. To update us on the protests that have been months long, joining us by phone now is Stephen Mufson. He's energy correspondent for The Washington Post. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So update us. I know most people by now have heard about the Dakota Access Pipeline, but who has been there protesting since April, I believe?
Well, people have been protesting there for months, but it has really heated up recently, partly because of the celebrities that have gone out there. Mark Ruffalo, Jesse Jackson, a lot of people from all over the country. And it's also heated up because it's been more of a confrontation. Lots of police have showed up to try to keep people off Army Corps land and out of the pathway of the pipeline. And 141 arrests were made just one day last week alone.
And what are the reasons, first off, for this pipeline, and then the reasons against construction of it?
Yeah, the motivation is to try to build a transportation link that would take crude oil from the boom area of the Bakken in northwest North Dakota and to take that oil to a place where it can be refined and hook up with other pipelines, and that would be in Illinois. So it's about a 1,170-mile pipeline that would carry 500,000-600,000 barrels a day.
And the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, they're found in both North and South Dakota. So this pipeline construction is about a half a mile away from the reservation. But what are some of their concerns?
Well, their concerns are twofold. One, they don't want sacred grounds and burial grounds to be disturbed. Also, with there are some notable archaeological sites in that area. And the second concern is the danger of a leak in the pipeline that could occur on a river crossing and pollute the waters that they use for all sorts of purposes. The company has taken precautions about that. It's saying that it's going to dig 90 to 115 feet below the bottom of the river, quite a feat actually, but using horizontal drilling. But it's a big river. These pipelines are there a long time. There have been a few bad experiences in other parts of the country, and so that's a very real concern.
And so from the company's standpoint, they want this pipeline to be able to move, half a million barrels a day versus having to pay the cost of rail. But there are concerns, the environmental concerns and the concerns about how this is impacting the tribe and the sacred lands that are near that pipeline.
That's right. I mean, the company will argue that this is safer than carrying it by rail car, and of course it's cheaper. But there is a group of people that says, well, it's not a question of rail versus pipe. A lot of environmentalists just want to keep that oil in the ground. That's an important development in the environmental movement in these last 4 or 5 years, the idea that you would try to cut off pipelines as sort of the middle stage of the whole supply chain, and that would encourage people to move faster toward renewables.
Let's talk about who's profiting from this project. Obviously, the government of North Dakota would be getting millions, but at the same time, they've been spending millions on security because of these protests.
Right. I think the government is going to get its tax revenue probably either way, except, of course, if this ends up discouraging producers from producing in that area at all. But the real winners are the oil producers in the Bakken area, which will have new options for transportation. The pipeline company itself, of course, and there will be some additional tax benefits perhaps in certain jurisdictions. But the big winners would be the pipeline company and the people drilling for oil in northwest North Dakota.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. On the phone with us is Stephen Mufson. He's energy correspondent for The Washington Post. Today we're looking at what's been happening in North Dakota with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and many Indian nations around the country, as well as many Americans joining this protest against this multi-billion dollar pipeline. If you want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Now, Stephen, I understand you've covered the Keystone XL pipeline and the controversy surrounding that. What are the parallels between this project?
There are a lot of parallels. The Keystone raised a lot of water issues across an enormous number of waterways, and it also crossed a lot of Native American lands. I did a story about that out of Oklahoma because there are an enormous number of Native Americans in Oklahoma, of course, having been driven there by the federal government many, many years ago. So there are concerns there. Of course, in the end, they weren't completely resolved, and that northern part of the pipeline never got built.
President Obama only has a few more months in office. What could happen with the election of a new president, not only to this project here in North Dakota, but the Keystone XL application?
Well, the Keystone application, the Keystone fight is in court, actually. The TransCanada has filed suit, so that'll drag on for some time. In this case, I think that the pipeline, the president has indicated that the Army Corps will reconsider the route. The way he phrased that made it sound like it wasn't a question of blocking the pipeline so much as rerouting it, and he sounded optimistic about some sort of change. Of course, all this will be easier for him in a way after Tuesday. Doesn't want it to become a big electoral issue for Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton has issued a statement that was fairly neutral. It didn't really satisfy the environmentalists who are opposed to this pipeline, and there have been some tough words out of them about that.
When we look at why this route, again, that would be half a mile away from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, you know, the Army Corps studied an alternate route that would be along Bismarck. Why was that route not chosen?
Well, the opponents of the pipeline say that it wasn't chosen because it would have crossed areas where more white people live, basically. And this is one of the arguments against the pipeline, is that its route is kind of racist, is the way a lot of people put it, and that this is a question of environmental justice on top of everything else.
And could I ask you before we let you go, Stephen, when we talk about, again, the construction of this pipeline, you know, I've read differing accounts that this Texas-based company was beginning this construction long before all the necessary permits were in place.
I had not seen that, and I would doubt that very much. I mean, there are certain things you can do ahead of time. In the Keystone instance, I'm a little more familiar with that. There was a lot of construction that took place in Canada before they got the permits in the United States. And there was warehousing of equipment and things like that. But you couldn't actually cross they can't finish the pipeline. They can't do the most important parts of the construction without permits and without all the permits.
And because the Standing Rock Sioux had sued for an injunction, a judge ruled against that injunction, but there are parts of this construction that have been postponed. Is that right?
Well, the part where the protests are taking mm-hmm. place right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, this pipeline is about three-quarters built already. So this is one of the final areas, and it doesn't look like it's going to get resolved in the next few weeks.
And Stephen, also just a quick question from one of our listeners. You know, she is confused, and we're going to be talking about this later with some tribal members here in Connecticut, of why there is so much opposition if this pipeline is not going to be in the reservation, but it is on what's considered treaty land. Can you describe and explain that confusion?
Yeah, sure. The reservation was created by an act of Congress in 1889, I believe, but there were treaties earlier in 1851 and 1868, which gave a lot more land to Native Americans. So, and since the tribes are really considered sovereign, those treaties are in the minds of many people more important than the Act of Congress. The treaties ceded to the Sioux or Lakota people much more of the land west of the Missouri River than the reservation includes. So, part of what's involved in this whole controversy is a controversy about how Native Americans have been treated, whether they've really been treated as sovereign treaty participants or whether they've been treated in some harsher way. So that that border that people talk about is the reservation border. It's not the border in the minds of a lot of Native Americans, and of course they have traveled all over the region, and so there's a lot of archaeological and burial sites there.
I want to thank Stephen Mufson, energy correspondent for The Washington Post. It's good to get a good description of why this has become such an issue. Stephen, thank you so much for your time.
Glad to be here.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Again, we're talking about Standing Rock, a Sioux tribe in the North and South Dakotas. They have been joined by many Indian nations and other Americans in protesting this multi-billion-dollar pipeline. We're going to hear from two members of Connecticut tribes coming up after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The Dakota Access Pipeline Project has attracted national and international attention since the summer. Protesters, they call themselves protectors, have been gathering in North Dakota since April, when construction was first beginning on the pipeline that will carry more than half a million barrels of oil a day under the Missouri River and across four states. Just yesterday, interfaith clergy from around the country were the latest to make a stand against that pipeline. There are environmental concerns, of course, but the Standing Rock Sioux also say the pipeline project, located half a mile from the reservation, will harm the sacred land of its people. The whole confrontation recalls the painful history of the U.S. government taking land away from the first Americans. To talk more about how history is informing today's events in North Dakota, we're joined by two members of Connecticut tribes. They both have participated in what they say have been largely peaceful protests near Cannonball, North Dakota. In studio with me is medicine woman Melissa Tantaquidgeon-Zobel of the Mohegan tribe in Uncasville. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lucy.
Also, Dominique Beltran, a member of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation in southeastern Connecticut. Thank you, Dominique, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I'll start with you, Melissa. You traveled to North Dakota. Tell us what led you there.
Well, first, thank you so much for covering this important issue at Standing Rock, which has kind of been out of the media so much lately. And I'm also glad you mentioned water protectors, because that's really what I'm going to focus on. I was really brought into this issue, like many Americans, from what I wasn't seeing in the media and what I was hearing on social media. And our chief, Lynn Malerba, joined myself and several other tribal members in a rally in Hartford that was put on by some of the local environmental groups. And that was a wonderful grassroots movement. And from there, we became more involved with some of the folks at Standing Rock. The critical shift actually came from a 13-year-old girl in our tribe. She wanted to call all of us to really be our best selves and protect Mother Earth. And in fact, I actually have some of her words here. She went before our people. She said, "I am a water protector. When I found out that many tribes from all over the country were making a trip to Standing Rock, I began to think how important it was for my ancestors and how sad it was that the pipeline would go through their sacred grounds. And I thought about how important water is to all tribes and all humans. And in my soul, I needed to be there. And I told my dad I had to go." So that's Joyce Iloff, Dancing Willow. And so she and her dad and some other Mohegans headed to Standing Rock. I went with my husband, and I was very fortunate that our tribe had, of course, like many of the other tribes, we had given, you know, monetary gifts and were bringing presents and many basic supplies to the tribe. We were also fortunate that we had a kind of a special gift, and I can talk about that later.
And Dominique, you're with the Mashantucket Pequot tribe, also in southeastern Connecticut. When did you go to North Dakota?
We went in mid-September. There was actually two vans of us. I was reading about it a lot for about 2 weeks, and every night I would read about it, my heart would hurt, and I just decided I have to get out there. I have to do something. I have to be there. I just was drawn there. So kind of recruited my mom, and we drove out there, and we prayed with them. We witnessed a lot of ceremonies from different nations. We were welcome right away. I can't find the perfect sum of words to describe how overwhelmingly beautiful it was. Just to pull up to the entrance of the camp and see the perimeter of the entrance lined up with the different nations' flags, right away I immediately decided I didn't want to leave. I didn't even get out of the car yet. So, it was an honor to be there and to be surrounded by so much love and just so much good medicine. It was an honor.
You know, we heard from the Washington Post reporter earlier in the show about how a lot more attention now on Standing Rock because of celebrities and certain media accounts. But, you know, there have been some confrontations, but largely, you say, when you were there, peaceful protests.
Very peaceful. It's what they have going on there now with the militarized police forces and the shootings and the tear gas and everything is completely unnecessary. These are the most peaceful group of people I have ever met in my whole life. It's really sad to see it, and that's why I appreciate you guys giving us the opportunity to actually share what's really going on in the camps. It's nothing but love. There's just this natural order and respect for everyone and everything. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. It feels right when you're there. You don't want to leave. It sucks you in.
And explain how this particular pipeline project has unified Indian nations around this country.
Well, it's really just been incredible. All of the different people that we have encountered at Standing Rock and elsewhere are all on the same page. And this isn't just really Indian nations. I kind of want to expand beyond that. Yesterday and the day before, there were about 500 clergymen who went to Standing Rock. And while I was there, I met with my counterparts from Standing Rock, the medicine chief, Orville Looking Horse, and others. And of course, they're amazingly wonderful, peaceful protectors. But what was even perhaps more striking was the people who came there from just everywhere, Indian and non-Indian people, in an unprecedented unity. We went to a ceremony, and I remember beforehand there were certain restrictions that we had to follow there about how we dressed and so on to be appropriately covered up, but not anything too rigid. And one woman who was running the ceremony just asked a young non-Indian woman if she could just make sure her halter top covered her a little bit, and she just said, "Right on, sister, and thank you." And the respect and the love, there's a sign up at Standing Rock. It says, "Remember to behave respectfully, peacefully, fearlessly, and with humor wherever possible."
But for people who are listening, are they surprised to hear that members of Connecticut tribes are traveling all the way to North Dakota?
Out here they were, because it's such a long trip. It took us about 30 hours to get there driving. And some of the people at the camp, too, they were also surprised to hear how far we had driven. But it's actually quite common when you get out there. There's people from Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Canada, everywhere coming. So it's really not surprising.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're looking at the Dakota Access Pipeline Project, and we're talking with two Connecticut residents, members of Connecticut tribes, the medicine woman Melissa Tantaquidjan-Zobel, the Mohegan tribe, and Dominique Beltran of the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation. Both have traveled over to North Dakota in solidarity for the protests that are going on there, not just about the pipeline project, of course, but for the rights of the indigenous people. I wanted to take a phone call from a listener now. Rochelle is calling in. Rochelle, you're on the show.
Hi. I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
And where are you calling from, Rochelle?
I'm calling from the Cheyenne River, where I serve continuously, although I am a Connecticut resident. I live in Glastonbury. I commute back and forth to South Dakota on a regular basis for the nonprofit.
Rochelle, it sounds like, I don't know if you're moving or if it's just windy, but it's very hard to hear you. I don't know if you could just, again, explain where you are?
Yeah, I'm off speaker now, so that should be better.
Okay, Rochelle, tell us where you are, because we're really having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. I am on the Cheyenne River Lakota Sioux Indian Reservation, which is in also in the suit against the Dakota Access Line. We are attached to physically the Standing Rock Reservation. They are relations, and all of us will be affected by the water if it's contaminated through the pipeline. So it directly affects both tribes because we all receive our water from the Missouri. So it is a joint effort between Cheyenne River and Standing Rock.
And when you're out there, I mean, what can you tell us what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to talk a little bit about the militarization that Melissa began, because it has gotten to an extremely dangerous point. I was brought out yesterday. I was up on the camp yesterday, and there are snipers literally surrounding the camp up on the hills, which is an eerie and scary component of what happened at the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890, having been surrounded by long guns and automatic weapons that are aimed down at the camp presently as we speak. We have had, these are my people from Cheyenne River, and we have had many of our young people brutalized by the attacks. There have been no aggression on the part of the tribe. They are adamant about it. We are not allowed to have weapons, alcohol, drugs of any sort within the camp in order to keep this appropriate and keep the focus on the issues. We had a young man who's a very close friend of mine in Inipi, which is the sweat lodge, which for us is equivalent to going to a church, a mosque, or a synagogue. The sweat lodge was ripped down. The young people were pulled out of it, thrown into the mud, and kept there while they were being arrested. They've been terribly traumatized by what happened. Their sacred objects, like our chanupa, our sacred pipe, were taken away. Arville Looking Horse, who is a dear friend of mine, is our spiritual leader, as Dominic said. He went back to try to collect those sacred objects and has not been able to do that. So we've had a great deal of aggression against us, even though we are on U.S. Army Corps land where the camp is, which we have been given permission by the U.S. government to be on.
Well, Rochelle, thank you so much for giving us some of your observations. I wanted to bring into the conversation now Mary Catherine Nagel. She's a partner at Pipestem Law Firm and executive director for the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. Mary Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So given the long history, when we look back at the U.S. government taking Native American land, what does this particular Dakota Pipeline project signify?
Well, first I'd just like to thank the last speaker who called in. I missed her name, but I very much appreciate her perspective, and I also appreciate all that Melissa and Dominique have said. I think the question of what does this signify, I would change that to what does this repeat, because, you know, you can certainly draw connections to things the United States government has done in the past and say what's happening today is a symbol for what's happened in the past, but it's really a pure repetition, and it's pretty starking when you just look at it. And I know Wounded Knee has been brought up. I think it's somewhat ironic that the state of North Dakota has, from the very beginning, put a lot of effort into escalating violence in a situation that initially had no violence. The Dakota Access Company is the company that brought out the private security force and attack dogs that were used against peaceful protesters. And I think people have to put it into context, right? I mean, here you have a litigation where a sovereign tribal nation has said, absolutely not, we do not consent to anyone destroying our sacred sites, our burial grounds, or destroying or damaging our drinking water. And in response, this private company and the federal government, because the federal government is really the entity being sued here for having authorized several permits without consulting with the tribal nations that are implicated or that are involved, the private company said, well, tell us where the sacred sites are. We don't believe you. You say there are sacred sites along the path of the pipeline. Tell us where they are. Well, on September 9th, the tribe did. They filed papers saying, okay, we went out and we've marked, you know, here are the exact locations of our sacred sites in the path of the pipeline. Well, the next day, the pipeline company moved its construction company to construct on top of those sites. And then when peaceful protesters went to those sites to demand the company stop destroying sacred sites, that's when the private security company put attack dogs on them. So, you know, that's, you could say that signifies or symbolizes violence, but it's just, it's more than that. It's a repetition of the state and federal government sponsored violence that the United States has seen and used against Native people from, you know, 500 years ago till now. So it's sad, it's tragic. It's time for things to change, that's for sure. But it certainly, you know, I think a lot of us are shocked, but then again, you know, we still live in a country that has not really achieved full recognition of what has happened over the last several hundred years and all of the, I think, horrific things the United States federal government did in an effort to eradicate tribal nations. So, because we have amnesia with regards to those historic events, I think we also have a hard time seeing the current events for what they truly are in relation to the historic events.
Mary, you said that you know, we have amnesia, but it appears, and we heard from Medicine Woman Melissa Tantaquidjan-Zobel earlier, that it's not just you know, tribal members from around the country that are joining in opposition to this pipeline project and what it means, but also many Americans from all different backgrounds and faiths and cultures that are, you know, standing up for the people of Standing Rock. Isn't that an acknowledgement of some of the past transgressions?
I will say we have acknowledgement when, for instance, the United States Supreme Court overturns its 1823 decision saying that tribal nations cannot claim legal title to their land because their citizens are, quote, racially inferior, savages, and heathens. It is wonderful that we have Americans who, some of them for the first time, are saying, you know what, it's not okay to point a gun at a Native child just because she doesn't want to see her sacred site destroyed. You know, that's wonderful, but I don't know how many Americans it is. I think I'm sure it's a few million at this point. It still hasn't been enough to overturn a Supreme Court legal framework that still says to this day that we are savages and heathens and that we have no religion protected by the Constitution and that we don't have jurisdiction over non-Indians who come onto our lands and commit crimes. It hasn't yet affected. We still haven't seen the Obama administration say, you know what? We actually made a mistake. We didn't consult with the tribal nations involved here. We are stopping this pipeline. That hasn't happened yet.
This is where
we
live. Mary, I just want to reset real quick because I want to get our in-studio guests to respond to what you're saying. But this is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with us are two Connecticut residents who've traveled to North Dakota who are members of Connecticut tribes. I want to first turn to Melissa Tantaquidjan-Zobel. Your response to what Mary Catherine's been saying?
She's 100% right. This is a battle that at its root has to deal with a history of treatment that is very, very wrong. The 1851 treaty rights of the Standing Rock are at stake here. Their federal trust management responsibilities are at stake here. Their sacred sites and burials and environmental protection. But at its root, we're dealing with issues that could be protected and are actually protected, strangely enough, under federal law. Indians are protected by the Constitution. Our treaties are protected. But these laws simply aren't carried through. And so, a lot of this is about attitude, and it's time for that attitude to change.
Dominique?
It's just frustrating for me because Obama literally could just put a stop to it, and he's just not doing that. And it's also frustrating because I feel like if this were reversed and we were disregarding treaties or laws, then we would be held accountable. So I feel like accountability needs to be held on every level.
Let's bring in the Oregon occupation that happened into this conversation. I'll turn back to Mary Catherine Nagel, partner at Pipestem Law Firm, executive director for the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. You know, NPR reported that the most high-profile show of tribal unity since that occupation has been the protests at Dakota Access Pipeline. You know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I think it has been a time of incredible tribal unity I know Melissa and Dominique both spoke about their time there. I have to say that my visits out there have been some of the most powerful experiences of my life. And to see so many different tribal nations bring their children, their citizens, but mostly their tribal leaders as well, to bring gifts, to bring their ceremony, to bring their culture, to bring their prayers, and all in a peaceful way. And everyone who stepped foot in that camp has been incredibly affected. I haven't met anyone who stepped inside that camp and said, huh, that was interesting. It's, you know, it's very powerful. And I think because you see that the people who are there, the tribal leaders who are there, the nations that have come to stand with Standing Rock and to stand in prayer. And they've accepted the chairman's message, which is simply, we're here in ceremony. We're here in prayer. And they're going to, you know, yes, they're pointing their guns at us and they're threatening us with violence, but we are not going to react with violence. And it's, you know, you can study these kinds of movements in history and look at MLK and Gandhi, and it's, there's a huge, powerful, peaceful, prayerful civil rights movement happening right now. One of the most powerful, the most powerful I've seen in my lifetime. It's happening in North Dakota. And I do so appreciate that we're talking about it today on the radio, but it's pretty amazing how, considering how powerful it is, how little media coverage it's getting.
I want to take a phone call now. Mary, stay with us. Bud's been holding from New London, Connecticut. Bud, you're on the show.
Hi, thank you so much. I'd just like to echo everything that's already been said. When I was I'm in New London, Connecticut, and went to school here. When I was a kid, my scoutmaster was friends with Harold Kennequin, who was chief at the time. When his sister passed away a few years ago, there was a quote from their father: "It's hard to hate someone you know a lot about." This is about environmental justice, racial justice. And a quote from the UCC, the United Church of Christ website, from Martin Luther King: "Our goal is to create a beloved community, and this will require a qualitative change in our souls, as well as a quantitative change in our lives." The UCC is having a whole series of conversations on racial justice. And, you know, the oil is not about need, it's about greed. You know, we don't need it. There's going to be a whole shift towards 100% renewable energy. And this whole thing about violence, you know, our whole economy is based on big oil, military defense, and the war on drugs. And we need to shift that whole consciousness. Stephen Pavar, who's probably one of the most knowledgeable lawyers on Indian law in the United States, points out how arbitrary Indian law is. And every time they get close to justice, the laws change. And I just, Mary Oldman Tucker at Yale in Journey of the Universe points out that we need a new story, that the old story isn't working anymore. So we need a new cosmology, you know, and hold the earth in sacred trust, or it's not going to be here for future generations.
Well, thank you, Bud, for calling in and giving us your thoughts. Melissa, did you want to respond?
Sure. Thank you, Bud. I think this is the Bud that I know from some time back. That is wonderful to bring in the notion of it's hard to hate someone that you know a lot about, because I know our chief, Lynn Malerba, has worked for some time on a national Indian curriculum. That's something that might at least make a dent in some of this lack of information. Much of what we're fighting, besides invisibility, especially here in New England as Native people, is just a lack of historical information. Our history books are vacant. And so we need to have a place in the dialogue of American history. And people need to understand the place of American law as it intersects with Native American law. So I'm grateful to have Mary Catherine here to share that.
I wanted to turn back to Mary Catherine Nagel again. She's executive director for the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. You mentioned that there hasn't been a lot of media attention on what's been going on at Standing Rock. But, you know, beyond talking about the issues of climate change and the need for renewables and the rights of indigenous people and the rights for water protection, but, you know, should more attention be given to the Native American people in this country? I was just looking at Standing Rock's website the other day, and they list the number of their tribe that are able to work. And I believe it said that the number of unemployed is at 70%. That's mind-boggling when you see that number.
Yes, well, I think, you know, once again, when you look at the history of how the United States was formed and created, a lot of damage and violence was done to tribal nations and their citizens. And, you know, you can really understand when you've, you know, let's say, for instance, if we were to show up in the United States today and tell all Americans, you can't work anymore. The way you feed yourselves is not going to be possible. There's this totally other new thing you've never done before, but you have to go do it right now. And if you can't feed yourselves, you'll starve. And that's basically what happened. It's like, okay, you've lived off the buffalo for thousands of years. We're going to send the army out to slaughter all the buffalo. Now go and try and survive. And all the violence. And I think that, you know, everyone keeps talking about historical trauma. There's been numerous studies that have been performed to show, I've heard of studies that can show DNA markers in certain people whose grandparents or great-grandparents were on the Trail of Tears. The scientists are finding new ways to find historical trauma literally in the body. And I think what's alarming about that, when you look at numbers today and you can say, okay, you know, we know that our Native youth have PTSD rates four times as high as troops coming back from the war in Afghanistan. What does that mean? And I think what it means is, well, we can also say, look, we know that our Native women experience the highest rates of sexual assault, rape, domestic violence, and murder in the country. What does that mean? And I think it just means the war hasn't ended. And I think in part the war, and that's what we're seeing in North Dakota today and what you see in all these statistics. And I think it goes back to what the caller Bud was mentioning, which is we need a new narrative. The narrative that brought us the Supreme Court decision that says we're savages and heathens, the narrative that supports a contemporary current, you know, governor of a state using this kind of militarized force against tribal citizens, against American Indians, there's a narrative in place that's been around for a couple hundred years that says Indians are savages, they're dangerous, you know, that they're different than us. And that narrative is based off of a prejudice that can only continue to exist as long as there's ignorance. And I think that the more that Native people in the United States can tell their stories and share them in the media, in Hollywood, on the American stage, that's what YPAP at Yale, the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program, is all about. I truly believe, as much as I've criticized the United States government and perhaps other folks on the call today, I truly believe that once Americans know and hear the stories of our American Indian people in the United States, their hearts and minds will change. And I think that, so I think once we can get our stories out there, there will be a change in that underlying narrative that has allowed a lot of the historical violence to continue through today.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Mary Catherine Nagel, partner at Pipestem Law Firm and executive director for the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. Before we go, I want to turn back to our in-studio guests. Where do you go from here?
Well, this weekend we actually have a veterans powwow at the Mashantucket-Pequot Museum. So we are trying to gather goods, non-perishable items, blankets, coats, anything that you could bring to donate and send out to Standing Rock. So that would be appreciated. I think grand entry starts at 11. So if anybody can make it, come and witness some good dancing, some good food, and donate and enjoy yourself.
I want to thank Dominique Beltran, member of the Mashantucket-Pequot Tribal Nation, and also medicine woman Melissa Tantaquidgeon-Zobel at the Mohegan Tribe in Uncasville. Thank you both for coming on today.
Thank you for having us.
Tabatni.
Coming up, what's happening with pipeline projects in New England? We'll find out more from Hartford Current reporter Greg Ladke after this short break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Did you know there have been multi-million-dollar pipeline proposals to help meet electricity demand here in New England? Well, joining me now is Greg Ladke, an environment, energy, and agriculture reporter for the Hartford Courant. He's going to update us on where these proposals stand. Good to see you again, Greg.
Good to be here.
So tell us about the projects. And I understand there's been some, stalled effort in getting these projects to come here.
Yes. The State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection here in Connecticut just halted consideration of a number of these major proposals. One of the biggest ones was a pipeline plan that was going to cost something like $3.3 billion and stretch all the way across Massachusetts and into New Hampshire. That was dropped in April. The huge pipeline company that was promoting it decided that there was too much opposition.
Kinder Morgan, is that right?
Kinder Morgan. Mm-hmm. And they're the biggest pipeline infrastructure company in the nation. They decided that there was so many protests and so little chance that the financing would come through that they stopped. They dropped their project. Now, the financing is a key here because what is being was being proposed for that and other pipeline projects was that electricity ratepayers pick up the tab for basically most of the pipeline project over the next 20, 30, 40 years. There were protests from consumer groups. There were protests from environmentalists who felt that we didn't need more reliance on a fossil fuel, even though natural gas is considered cleaner than other fossil fuels. But the pressure was still on until the High Court in Massachusetts ruled, I believe it was in August, that tax ratepayers in that state didn't have to be or could not be charged with the cost of this project. And a similar administrative ruling in New Hampshire basically said the same thing for their ratepayers, which left Connecticut, which has already passed legislation that would allow ratepayers to pick up the cost for these projects, in limbo. And that's why the state withdrew consideration of another big project, which would have dramatically expanded the existing Algonquin pipeline across Connecticut.
So this news is good for environmentalists, but bad for the Malloy administration, right, who's been pushing natural gas infrastructure expansion.
They have been Daniel Malloy and his administration have been all in on getting more natural gas into Connecticut. They want to not only expand its use by homeowners and businesses, but also to produce more electricity. The energy industry and a lot of studies say that there's a dramatic need for more natural gas in the New England region. They say that consumers would have saved billions of dollars over the recent years if there had been more natural gas available. Environmentalists and other studies will say we don't need that, and you can reduce the amount of gas that you need by conservation and alternative sources such as solar or wind power.
So where does that stand now with this the state having to invest now in these alternative energy projects? We'd had you on just a few months ago talking about the debate around more solar fields on old farmland and wind power in Connecticut. I mean, what's happening there?
Those projects are still going forward in the state, but the state energy officials point out that they won't make up for the lack of natural gas. In other words, there's a big, big demand for energy. Solar power and wind power and hydropower will help, but they're saying we need a lot more fuel to produce the energy that's in demand here. So it's right now it's in limbo, I think.
Mm-hmm. And earlier you were saying because of the court decisions in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, so really we don't – the state doesn't want just the Connecticut ratepayers to be on the hook for this for years to come.
Exactly. It's just too big a project. The Algonquin Line project that Eversource and other partners are involved in would cost $3.3 billion. Connecticut ratepayers might be willing to pick up a share of that, but not the whole tab.
You know, we often focus on what's going on in our region, in New England. You know, are other states doing it better in terms of investing in this alternative in energy?
Massachusetts seems to be doing better, particularly with solar power. The state has put up solar fields along the Mass Pike and some other state roads. Connecticut is lagging in that area. There are wind
power. Why are they lagging?
It's a whole range of reasons that have been given. Some of it is the lack of upfront financing by the state because it costs money to prepare for these kinds of things. Others, it's just a matter of bureaucratic slowness. The state is still working to figure out exactly how much electricity comes from that they pay for in each individual building. They may know, for example, how much electricity all the prisons in Summers use, but they don't know particularly, or they're starting to get a handle on how much each building uses and which ones would benefit from a solar power or some sort of fuel cell operation. So it's a long, I mean, there are 4,000 different structures owned by the state, or almost that many. And it's been a long, slow, multi-year process trying to figure this out.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Greg Ladke, Environment, Energy, and Agriculture reporter for the Hartford Current. We're talking about energy plans for Connecticut. Now, we know from what you're saying that these plans to expand infrastructure are in limbo, as you said, but there is increased demand. What does that mean for us here in Connecticut if we just remain in limbo while there's electricity demand growing?
The energy industry will say that it's going to cost consumers more because they simply don't have – and that the energy supplies are not as secure as they would have been if you expanded the pipeline capacity. So what we're seeing is a situation where environmentalists are saying, well, just push ahead with alternative energy sources. And the state is doing that. And the state has also approved or is in the process of approving smaller natural gas operations to produce energy, fuel cell operation in western Connecticut, electricity-generating natural gas plant in the Killingly area in eastern Connecticut. So these projects are moving forward, but the big source of energy, a new energy for Eversource and electrical production generating plants, that's still up in the air.
You know, just the other day, Eversource sent out a release saying that the standard service winter rate will be the lowest it's been in a while. How's that happen?
That's in part because of natural gas is less expensive. Oil prices are down. The warm weather means reduced demand. So, we have these conflicting projections and forecasts, and there is a certain degree of help being done because there's more and more solar energy being produced in Connecticut, whether it's homeowners or these solar fields that are going up, sometimes on farmland, sometimes on places like forests that are cutting down. So it's one of these deals where people are sort of in between. We want more energy, but we want it to be clean. And sometimes you can't have both.
I want to thank Greg Ladke, Environment, Energy, and Agriculture reporter for the Hartford Current. It's a confusing topic. We're going to want to check in with you again during the session. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm about to lose my voice. The show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. This is Where We Live.